Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, to bring you opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, October 7th, 2014. Good afternoon, Al.
Well, Melody.
Well, it's been an active day in the markets today. Gold has been able to at least maintain the level at $1,211, up $3.90 today. Silver had a little bit of a pullback down. Let's see, that just adjusted down 14 at 1731. We have platinum up 11 at 1262. And we have palladium up 21 at $786. The USDX today is trading down slightly, 0.08 at 85.66. Crude oil took another beating today, down 1.58 at 88.76. And the paper markets today, one of their worst days of 2014. And, the Dow was down triple digits most of the day, but I'd say this last 100 points came in within the last 45 minutes of trade. I mean, it just dropped in the last moments of trade. You have the Dow down 272 points, 1.60% at 16,719. The S&P tumbled 1.5%, down 29 points at 1935. And the NASDAQ tumbled just a little over 1.5%, down 69 at 43.85, and the 10-year yield tumbled right along, down 0.08 at 2.35%. So an interesting day in the markets, to say the least. And I think that a little bit of fear is beginning to creep into the markets. Whether it be the fear of ISIS in some sort of situation, whether it be the fear of Ebola, or whether it be the fear that the market is just overbought and it's ready to tumble, or the fear of no more stimulus coming into the markets, or the fear of Germany and the European nations coming out with less than stellar reports on their economy, particularly Germany. Let's see, did I miss any, Al?
Yes, you did.
What?
The fear of October.
The fear of October.
October is always, well, not always, but it has a reputation of sorts for being one of the most volatile months for stocks. And actually, it's had the beginnings of significant recessions and an economic and declines and rest that showed up in the stock markets in October in the past. And some people are just kind of worried about October.
Well, you know, September is usually the most volatile month of the year for markets. But October has seen the major crashes occur in October. Plus, we can't forget that tomorrow is the full moon, and we certainly do have a blood moon coming our way. So, you know, there's a lot of theories and a lot of, you know, depending on where what you believe and, you know, whether this is a spiritual warnings and signs that you can look to.
We got enough problems with it. We've got enough problems with Obama and the marketeers manipulating the market without, oh my gosh, are we going to have to start reading spiritual messages into this also, Melody?
I think so. I think if you believe it's a spiritual battle, then I would take those signs very seriously.
I understand the spirituality, you know, and in fact, for what it's worth, I didn't even understand the concept of spiritual warfare. I don't think I'd even heard of it until probably about 1991, 92. People started telling me about it, and I didn't understand really what they were talking about. But over the years, I've come to understand, and there's no doubt in my mind now. Now it's just kind of obvious to me we're involved in spiritual warfare, which is not to say that everything we see is some sort of manifestation of that warfare. We have spiritual warfare, and we also have greed warfare, and we also have stupid warfare. And sometimes it's hard to understand, are we dealing with something spiritual here or just something stupid? You understand, is it spiritual or is it ordinary greed? What's going on here? But there's certainly kind of warfare that's persisting at all times.
Well, you have student loans that hit a record high of $1.2 trillion. And, of course, that puts, you know, it's just another sign of the times. You also have Walmart. They're eliminating health care insurance coverage for some part-time workers. Now, if we all remember what I've been talking about, you do have the corporate compliance to Obamacare beginning January 1st. 2015. Remember, they were extended. They were given a reprieve. They didn't have to comply when everybody else did, when small business had to, but the big corporations, they were given till 2015. So you have Walmart stores, they're planning to eliminate health insurance coverage for their part-time U.S. employees in a move aimed at controlling rising health care costs of the nation's largest private employer. They told the Associated Press today that starting January 1, it will no longer be offering that insurance for those employees who work less than an average of 30 hours a week. It's going to affect about 30,000 employees, or about 5% of their total part-time workforce. And this even comes at a time when the company, when Walmart, has already scaled back the number of their part-time workers who were eligible for the health insurance back in 2011. So this is a double whammy to the employees. And this announces, and of course we've seen similar decisions by Target, Home Depot, and of course other of these large corporations that to completely eliminate health insurance benefits for part-time employees. So
Obamacare is helping to get more people uninsured. Yeah, we have, by the time we're done with this, the only people that are going to have Obamacare will be those of you who work more than 80 hours a week. Melody, that'll include you. You'll be entitled to it. I won't qualify because I don't work more than maybe 70 hours a week, so I don't qualify. But hoping.
It's silly, silly.
I'm gonna hurt my neck from shaking my head. Do you understand that? Just to protect my neck from shaking my head. I look at some of the stuff. Oh my gosh.
But and since September 2011. Oh, I take that back. Food stamp recipients has topped 46 million for 35 straight months. And of course, that's according to the data that was released by the Department of Agriculture. Since September 2011 to July 2014, the number of persons participating in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program,
SNAP,
has exceeded 46 million. So it's 46,486,434 beneficiaries of the SNAP program.
That's about 14% of the population that's on the SNAP program. Now, one of the things that somebody else has pointed out that is interesting and insightful to me, at least, is that during the Great Depression, we had soup lines.
Yes.
Right? When we talk about 46, 47 million people that are in the SNAP program, we are talking about, just on average, 1 million people per state. Not quite that many, but just ballpark figure, 1 million people per state. What would we think about the economy if there were 1 million people in Texas or New York or Nebraska or Oregon or whatever, every day lined up to get free food for lunch? For breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What if we had those soup lines were back here another time? And the point, I don't remember who made the observation, but his point was, we are in a circumstance that's very much like the Great Depression. We've got 15% of the people that are essentially in soup lines, only we've managed to automate it with little debit cards and one thing and another like that, where we don't see them lining up, but that's essentially what's going on right now. And it's an interesting insight. SNAP equates, at least to some degree, with the idea of soup lines during the Great Depression. And it raises questions about where are we? Where is the economy in this country right now?
Well, another way, in 2013, 1 in 5 American households, or 20%, participated in the SNAP program. So when you're looking in your neighborhood and you count 5 little houses, just think. I mean, these numbers are incredibly huge.
Yeah,
and it's you're right. We don't visually see the impact.
No.
The only ones
it's hidden, but it's here.
It's here. And the only ones that appreciate it are those who pay the taxes. And because that's where, you know, our taxes keep going higher. Those who get the programs, they don't see. They don't care. They don't have to.
You know, it's maybe even a situation where it's not simply true that people who are employed don't notice the people who are unemployed. In some regards, the people who are unemployed don't notice themselves. And what I mean by that is this. I'm wondering, if I had to line up every day in a soup line at a soup kitchen to eat, and I'm lined up with a bunch of other people that are unemployed and impoverished, I become aware of my circumstances more so, I suspect, than I would be if I were collecting a daily or a monthly support from the government to pay for my food. I don't. Do you see what I'm saying here, Melody?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the soup line kind of rubs your nose in it that you're impoverished. Mm-hmm. The little debit card or whatever they're passing out in the SNAP program, it does not. And that's important, I suspect, just to keep people from feeling bad about themselves, being aware of how of their circumstances to a point where they might want to demonstrate or even riot.
It's part of the illusion. I mean, they need that in order to do the illusion, just like the stock market.
Yeah.
Hey, the stock market's high, so everything. I might be doing terrible. I might not have a job. I might be on the SNAP program, but yeah, it must just be me because the stock market's doing well. So there's a lot of wealthy people out there. It's all part of their illusion, and it's the same way with gold. We look at gold numbers. Why are they low? Why do they hate gold so much? Because you can't have a great economy with high gold numbers, but that will change.
I'm not sure that you can't have a great economy with high gold numbers. I'm not sure that that's true, but you cannot maintain the illusion that the dollar has value if gold is going up. You cannot maintain the illusion that the economy is being, the monetary system is being properly managed by the government. So they're doing a good job. Boy, they're really doing a wonderful job of maintaining the value of the dollar. No, they're not. We've lost 97% of the dollar's value in the last 42, 43 years. All right? We've got a national debt that's too big to ever be repaid. We have industries shipped overseas. I mean, the litany of problems is substantial. And they don't apparently want to be confronted by the barometer of gold at the moment. They don't want that. Therefore, the price is being held down. But they're going to see this reality before this is all over. Sooner or later, the only problem you have, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, I don't have a wristwatch, but I can tell you that sometime tomorrow morning, the sun's going to rise over in a direction over my left shoulder right now. I know about where it's coming up. I just don't know when it's going to happen. I don't have a wristwatch, if you understand what I'm saying. I can't tell you when. It's the same thing with the rest of this. It's the same thing with gold, same thing with silver. It's coming up, and it's coming up over there. I know where it's, but I can't tell you the time. And that's frustrating. It's annoying. It's frustrating, but nevertheless, still look at it and say, sun's coming up over there. I know about where it's coming up. I just can't tell you the exact time because I don't have a watch. So.
Well, there's been the October Pew Research Center. They surveyed 1,000 adults. 125 of the 248 Republicans said they are less confident in the government's ability to deal with the Ebola crisis. About as many say they have little or no confidence, 51%, in the federal government to prevent a major Ebola outbreak. Yeah. On the flip side, Democrats have a more optimistic outlook on the government's ability in preventing the spread of the virus. I mean, these aren't, you know, shocking numbers or anything. Just more than 69% of the Democrats say they have a great deal or fair amount of confidence in the government handling the Ebola scare, with 28% saying they have no confidence at all. Overall, the research revealed that U.S. citizens generally have confidence in their government to contain the Ebola virus, and that is our problem right there. But breaking down the numbers, 57% have a great deal or fair amount of confidence, while 41% have little or no confidence at all.
Interesting, because at least indirectly interesting, because the dollar is based on public confidence.
Yes.
And when we lose confidence in the government, in theory, this translates into loss of confidence in the United States dollar. Now, that's not a direct, that's not, you know, that's not a solid linkage, but it's there's a lot of validity to it. Here's another article on confidence from CNBC. And the headline is, survey, confidence in Obama sinks to all-time low. Americans' confidence in President Obama's economic leadership stands at an all-time low, despite an improving labor market, according to the latest CNBC All-America Economic Survey. Just 24% of Americans say they are extremely or quite confident in Obama's economic policies and goals, down from 33% when the question was last asked in June of 2013, the previous low point in the Obama presidency. And 44% of the public say that they have no confidence at all in the president on the economy. 44% have no confidence in the president and the economy. Now, this can't bode well for the markets. If half, we're talking roughly half the people in the country, don't think the economy is going to hold together, does that indicate, is that evidence that the market's in trouble? Or is it just, you know, is it just interesting information, or does it indicate that the market is vulnerable and the people don't believe in it? And if so, how long before that 44% begins to think in terms of, you know, maybe I ought to get some gold?
You ought to be, you'd have to be brain dead to be in these markets, either brain dead or just put in a position where you have no choice, where you have no options. And that's what these retirement plans and these employers and so forth, they don't give the employees options. It's this or that, or, you know, you don't have any choices. Yeah. But
and what you mean by that is, generically, you can either go into a paper debt instrument, or you can go into a paper debt instrument, or you can go into some commercial announcements. Frank is back there playing the music again. See, Frank is always playing that music.
Let's
We're going
to
take a
it.
Break. We're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm Alfred Addis, here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. Be right back. Please stay tuned.
prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com. Are you concerned about prescription drug dependency to stay healthy? Are you worried that the cost and availability of your medications may put your health at risk? Perhaps it's time you consider a natural, safe, and effective way to deal with your health problems. If only you knew where to start. Start right here. Tune in to Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. What's the special du jour, Melody?
We're going to continue yesterday's special, even with gold up today, 21-ounce silver eagles and 1/110th of an ounce gold eagle that has a $5 face value on it. It's great for your little bartering, for your little purchases, along with your silver eagles. You know, gold should be your savings account, and silver is your checking account. And, of course, this gives you a little bit of both and a small fractional piece of gold in order if you do need to purchase something a little bit smaller and you don't want to sell that big ounce, you have 1/10th of an ounce. And, again, much more recognizable and acceptable than grams. $544. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And visit our website at dgscoins.com. DG as for discount gold silver coins.com.
Okay.
And today, yes. I was reading about, and there's always been discussions, I've heard this for a long time, but there's been a recent hearing. The Senate recently had a hearing on a bill that would make the district the 51st state. And there's also been discussions that Eric Holder is since he's such a natural advocate on D.C. statehood, he would lead the commission. And even it's been perhaps 3 months ago, but the president spoke in support of statehood. What's that all about, and why now?
I think it's Democrats posturing. We're talking about the Senate is advancing this idea. It's not going to get past the Republicans. They're not going to turn Washington, D.C. into a state because the city is basically black. They're not going to have two Democrat senators and at least one representative who will virtually always be Democrats to the Congress. Republicans will never go along with it, and that's assuming that they could. In the meantime, Obama's just playing to the audience. That's all he's doing, the Democrats and black Democrats in Washington, D.C. He's playing to them. Holder's playing to them. Senator's playing to them. We've got an election coming up in a month. This is just standard politics. How could they vote to change Washington, D.C. into a state? Washington, D.C. is established by the Constitution of the United States. Right? The proviso for Washington, D.C. is there. It is intended to be something other than a state. It's in the Constitution, and they're not going to change that without getting all 50 states, well, three-quarters of the 50 states, to go along with it and say, okay, this is a good idea. We'll turn Washington, D.C. into a state that has just as many senators, for example, as Texas. Ain't going to happen. Can't happen. Just politicians. That's all we got here. As a matter of fact, speaking of that, I got a couple of quotes on politicians. Here's one from Nikita Khrushchev. He says, politicians are the same all over. They promise to build a bridge even where there is no river. That's kind of what we're looking at right here. They're going to give statehood. No, they're not. And there's even good reason why they're not going to do that. You read the law, and I do from time to time. You will see that the definition of states in many of the United States Code titles, the states, they'll give you a list of states, and they include Washington, D.C. in that list of states. And they also include U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, American Samoa. It shifts around, but they include Washington, D.C. as a state in some of the statutes. What does that mean? It means that, in a sense, statutorily, they kind of already pretend they are states. But constitutionally, they are not. They need that distinction because I believe they're operating, as nutty as this I'm sure sounds to most people, I believe they're operating two separate planes, two separate venues, two separate jurisdictions. One is the states of the union. That's where everyone supposes we are. And the other is the states of the United States. We've got the states of the United States of America. That's an entity created by the Articles of Confederation and made more perfect. The Constitution says in order to form a more perfect union, the union is the United States of America. They created the United States, Constitution of the United States. It's a long, complex, and seemingly fantastic argument, but they're running two jurisdictions on us, in my opinion. And the second one is completely subject to the will of Congress. They are presuming that we are caught in states of the United States. They're presuming we are caught in territorial entities rather than states of the Union. States of the Union, we have a massive right. States of the United States, we are subjects. It's complex, but I don't, you know, to me, and I know it sounds crazy to the average person, so what the heck is that guy talking about? But I worked at it I've been looking at this stuff for over 30 years, and I even ran for the Supreme Court of Texas back in 1992. I know a little bit about the law, believe it or not. I don't have perfect knowledge, but I know a little about the law. These appear to be valid theories. And if they are, they aren't going to touch Washington, D.C. They may talk about it, and it's easy to talk about it. The Senate can say, oh, we're going to give you people in Washington, D.C., we're going to advance you to statehood. But they can count on the Republicans to make sure that doesn't happen. Republicans aren't going to lose control of the House in this next month's election, and they might even gain control of the Senate. So it's like me promising right now. I can promise that you're all going to fly. Yeah, vote for me in the November election, and you will all be able to fly like Peter Pan. Well, I know it's not going to happen. And when it does happen, I go, well, that's because the Republicans or the Democrats, they're the ones who wouldn't let you fly. If it was up to me, you could fly. You know, it just becomes nonsense.
Just to go back, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, about that Spanish nurse. And there's been commentary about, you know, if you look at the various pandemics, you know, everybody sort of reacts in the same similar way in these types of situations. And do you think this is, how do you think this is being used? Are these facts real, Al?
I don't doubt that the Spanish nurse has Ebola. I'm not going to doubt that. It's possible that there's a mistake in diagnosis, but I would bet that this is a legitimate diagnosis.
But this is a big
being
deal.
Used? See, again, the big question with Ebola is how communicable is it?
And this was the first time that it's been transmitted outside of Africa.
I understand that. Now, the question is, how many times can it be transmitted? How many times will it be transmitted? You know, as long as Ebola is only in Africa, we can all be afraid here in the United States. But once Ebola gets to the United States or it gets to Spain, and we see how it reacts in a, you know, essentially a first world medical facility, is it really as communicable as we're led to believe? If not, it's not cause for concern. In a sense, by having one case in the United States and having one case in Spain, if it essentially goes no further, that becomes evidence that this is not the boogeyman we've been led to believe. If it had only stayed in Africa, then we could all be afraid. Once it gets over here and we find out it can't be communicated, easily at least, you know, no big thing. We're going to have to move on to another subject. Melody, we're going to have to find another boogeyman.
You know, what's interesting is two of those people who were treated, that came to the U.S. and were treated, I read where they're back in the hospital. So my question is, while they were out floating around thinking they were cured and so forth, kind of makes you wonder if they were really cured at all.
It makes you wonder, you know, if you have a conspiratorial mindset. If you like conspiracy theories, this is the kind of thing that can...
I don't like conspiracy theories, but I also don't like, because you understand that you're never going to be told the truth coming from Washington. So, whenever these things are released, it's not conspiracy. It's, I know they're not telling the truth. And I understand that they can't create a panic, that they're trying to eliminate a panic. I get that. So,
no, I don't know if they're trying to eliminate the panic. My point is this. If it's true that they had a couple of people in the hospital who allegedly had Ebola, and the government and the hospitals allegedly cured them of that disease, and they went out in the world, and then, they came down with Ebola a second time, it means they weren't cured, point one. And point two, they may have communicated the disease into the public. Now, does this happen because the hospitals are incompetent? Or does it happen because the government wants some kind of panic? Do they want Ebola in the body politic in a way that everybody's, oh my gosh? And we don't know. But that kind of information you're just bringing might... You know, if you got a conspiratorial bent of mind, you go, oh, they're doing it intentionally to us. They're sending these people out back into the community to give us Ebola.
No, I don't think that. I just think perhaps they had a little more confidence in the medication. And I'm not quite sure that they were being returned to the hospital due to Ebola or they're having other problems. However, you know, process of elimination, if you had a disease and you ended up going back into the hospital a short time later – it's pretty much related to the same problem.
You'd think so.
You'd think so.
You'd think so. At least that's the possibility. Again, it goes to whether or not you believe, is there a boogeyman? Is there a conspiracy going on here? Or is this just
and my
stupid?
Question is, I mean, we've had so many threats and so forth and warnings of various things, the bird flu and this and that and everything else in these past couple of years. Why Ebola? You know,
I don't know. It's just something coming out of the dark continent, I think. You know, I'm not going to say that's true, but at least it's a possibility. Ooh, and Ebola has a strange kind of reputation that goes back at least into the 1980s and maybe even the 1970s. I don't know. I was talking to James Corbett on one of the programs in the last week or two, and he did some research on Ebola, and it first appeared, according to him, in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it was a strange thing. And I don't even remember what the alleged symptoms were, but people say, oh, this is, you know, it's like something coming out of voodoo or something like this. Oh, this is scary, you know, coming out of African jungles. Well, nothing much came of it. And now here we are again. There's a little bit of a fear factor that's built into Ebola that is not present in tuberculosis or even cancer. Because those two diseases, tuberculosis and cancer, are not mysteries to us. But Ebola, ooh, what is it? We don't know. It's serious, but what is it? You know?
Plus, you don't bleed from the eyes and everywhere else than with the high fevers and so forth. And, you know, every time I hear people, I shouldn't even say this on the radio, but, you know, you see there's so many, you look at Hollywood and what they produce, you know, with all of these pictures and so forth. And I think people, my idea, they relate to those movies. They relate to these programs. They relate I think that's where that, the fear of the unknown, because it's kind of fun. I'm going to be a zombie.
Let's go watch a horror movie. Don't go into that room all by yourself. They always do it, and we go to watch the movies every time. They say, you go into the West Wing, and I'll go into the East Wing, and we know the creature is going to get one of them. All right?
It's always the
And we go to watch it. We like these horror movies, that's all. And we like the same thing in our news media. We have a preference for boogeymen, you know, the unknown. Makes life kind of interesting. You know?
Well, is the IMF the boogeyman?
They won't admit to that, but they may be run by the boogeyman. I don't know. What's the IMF up to?
They're cutting its outlook for the global growth in 2015. And, of course, people listen to programs like this. We already know that. We could tell them. Maybe they're listening to these programs in order to give their prediction. But they're looking at global growth. Tightening.
Yeah, they say in July they predicted that the global growth would be 4%. And now, just a couple months later, they say, no, it'll be 3.8% 2.5 months later. They actually expect growth to increase in the United States to some degree, but globally they expect it to shut down. In advanced economies, this is the IMF said in the World Economic Outlook, in advanced economies, the legacies of the pre-crisis boom and the subsequent crisis, we're talking about prior to 2008, and the subsequent crisis, the Great Recession, including high private and public debt, right? Still casts a shadow on the recovery. Emerging markets are adjusting to rates of economic growth lower than those reached in the pre-crisis boom and the post-crisis recovery. Here's Frank again, playing the music. Well, we'll have to get back to that, and we'll talk more about the debt. That's the critical point. I'm Alfred Addis, here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. Be right back. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. 4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. We were talking about the debt. We've got a caller, Dan from Texas. Let's see what Dan has to say. Well, Dan.
Hey, what's up, Al? Melody, how y'all been?
Hi, Dan.
Not bad. What you got for us?
Hello, Frank. The only thing I'm thinking is this Ebola has been on how long in Africa? 6 months?
Okay, maybe the most recent outbreak. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and so sudden one person after 6 months shows up and all this stuff is gone. How many have come in before they put their defenses up have come in? You see what I'm saying? So all of a sudden...
We've got a real bad connection here, Dan. I'm having a hard time understanding what you're saying. You're kind of going in and out on this thing, and I'm not absolutely certain what you're asking.
Well, I had talked to Frank about it. This Ebola, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can right now.
Okay. Frank, you've been going on for 6 months, and after 6 months, it shows up, and all this hype goes up. He's got Ebola, and we're going through all this. How many people before that on airline traffic has come in here?
Yeah.
Don't know.
It's pretty simple. Well, I don't either. I mean, it's pretty simple. They've been coming in
you
6 months.
You know, this is one of the consequences. This is one of the consequences that is in every part of global free trade. One world government. All right, a global economy. People are jetting all over the world. They're even bringing animals along with them. I mean, it's part of the reason we have pythons running around. Big pythons running around or swimming around in the Everglades in Florida. We have a problem here, and it's one of the inevitable consequences of when you can't mind your own business and learn to live on your own little patch of land. We got to do something in China. We got to do something in Africa. We got to take advantage of things one place or another. I don't think there's anything to be done about it, but it points to a time when we're going to see some sort of a virus break loose in the world that's going to propagate from who knows where. Okay? I don't know where it's coming from. It might come from Africa, South America. It might come from Chicago. I don't know where it's going to come from, but all of a sudden it's just going to travel the globe in a matter of days or weeks. Have a pandemic.
Exactly.
And you
said that before, and I understand. So every person has to be his own country and help the other ones next to him.
As much as you can.
Silver and gold and everything you need. But what I'm saying is, after, you know, after 6 months, all of a sudden one third of the world are worried about it. Well, it's been going on.
Okay.
I mean, how many
Dan,
more?
Dan, the connection. Dan, the connection. Yeah, I get that there's a problem, but the connection I got with you is so degraded that we can't clearly hear what you're saying. The audience can't hear what you're saying. Either
try to reconnect, whatever.
But we can't make sense of what you're saying here very easily. Okay. All right. So, you know, that's it's part of interesting times. We are caught in circumstances where people can fly from the dark continent, Africa, right here to the United States in a matter of hours. And they are. And how do we prevent diseases from flying here, too? And, you know, they've got plants in Florida. I don't remember. Kudzu or something. I don't even remember the name of it. But some plants that are taking over the waterways. They've been introduced from foreign countries where they have, there's competition in foreign continents and foreign countries for those plants. The plants don't just overwhelm the environment. In this country, it doesn't have that kind of competition. The competitors that would normally keep that plant in check, they're not here. And so the plant just practically explodes. We're seeing things like that with pythons. I don't know what all we're going to see, but somewhere along the line, there's perhaps got to be less communication and travel between, you know, different parts of the world. And if we don't do that, and I know that sounds like a crazy idea, is, you know, I mean, I don't expect it to happen. But if we don't do it, if we don't find a way to minimize this global contact, it's inevitable. We're going to see a pandemic, and it won't be the bird flu. You understand? They had the bird flu, and I don't know what other kinds of flu, that were transmitted around the world. We had a global pandemic, I think back in the early 1900s, knocked out I don't know how many millions of people.
Black
but it was
flag.
Transmitted by birds flying around the world, all right, if I understand correctly. Well, we're not going to have another dose of the bird flu. We're going to have a dose of the 747 flu. We're going to have some sort of a virus that will be flying around the world, all right, right? But it won't be on a bird's wings. It'll be on a 747's wings. And it'll move a lot faster than the birds ever imagined. They talk about Ebola. Some people are saying, oh, it can be transmitted through the air. It's almost the least of our worries. If somebody sneezes, yeah, okay, that's a problem in theory. But it really can be transmitted through the air, but we're talking about through the air on a 747, not on a bird, not by a sneeze. Talking about continents can be infected. You know, sneezing, you can get the people in the room. 747, you can get the people in the world.
Well, you know, the Black Death happened so many years ago, but what spread that was the merchant ships. You know, that disease was, you know, in Asia, it started in Asia, and it just about wiped out Europe. You had, you know what, hundreds of million of people dying, it's sort of like the same thing because it was spread through transportation, merchant ships.
I understand that. And I have no doubt, I mean, it just now crosses my mind, the idea of a 747 flu. The system and the globalists, they want us to think in terms of, oh my gosh, the bird flu might come around again. The birds might transmit some disease to us. They don't want you to take a look at the 747s that might transmit the disease. Because if we do, if we start to see that, it's going to tend to inhibit multicult or multinational corporations. It's going to tend to inhibit globalism, one world economy, the rest of that. People start putting up, you know, if we rebuild our tariffs to protect industries in this country and learn to make our own computers and our own washing machines and so on, we put those tariffs back up, we will also put our national borders back up. They're part and parcel of the same concept. The idea, okay, we're going to stay over here, we're going to try to control this piece of territory and make it a decent place to live. And the rest of you, you do what you can with whatever you got. But don't come here. We'll take care of us. You take care of you. Globalists don't want that. And they want that, you know, communication, transportation, movement, unrestricted. They want it. And things like Ebola will work against that. So we shall see.
Well, onward.
Onward and upward. Talked about debt. We were talking about debt before Dan called in. And one of the things I'm beginning to appreciate, I've been harping about the debt. It's been the central feature in my understanding of the economic system for at least 5 years, maybe six or seven. I don't remember. The first time I read John Williams' material, and at the time I think the national debt was officially about $7 trillion, and John Williams said, no, it's not. If we calculate the way it's been calculated since the 1980s, the national debt is actually about $35 trillion. That was back 5-7 years ago whenever I first saw this. And I'm only vaguely recalling the numbers. But it was several times greater than the government claims. The government, the official debt is $7 trillion. Williams says now it's $35 trillion. Today the government says the debt has grown to $17 trillion. And Williams thinks it's closer to $90 trillion. Now, the point behind this, when I first saw this, I realized the debt couldn't be paid. And that was the great insight for me. Once you understand, if Williams is correct, and he says $90 trillion, and the Congressional Budget Office has come out since then, they say, no, including unfunded liabilities, it's actually about $202 trillion. And economist Lawrence Kotlikoff, he said, yeah, it's over $200 trillion. So there's reason to think that the debt could be 10, 11 times greater than the government officially admits, including unfunded liabilities. Five times more than what they admit just in terms of legitimate debt, if we can believe John Williams. That means we are the most indebted country in the world, bar none. The next closest is Japan. Their debt to GDP ratio is about 275%. They owe almost three times as much dollars worth of debt as they have GDP. Supposedly, our country has, we owe 1-to-1. Our national debt is supposedly about the same size as our GDP. Other countries have higher or lower. Right? But the truth may be that really we are about five times, if we can believe John Williams. We are five times deeper in debt than the government admits. And if we believe the Congressional Budget Office, we may be 11 times. What's it all mean? It means the debt can't be paid. All right, well, who cares? Right, that's not such a bad thing. We have things in the Bible. They have a jubilee in the Bible every 50 years where they wipe out all the debt. Right, zero it all out. Good thing. But that was in a system where you had a gold-based and an asset-based monetary system. We live in a debt-based monetary system, and if we zero out the debt, we zero out the correlative paper assets. Every time somebody borrows $100,000, someone else has a note with the borrower's signature on it that says, I promise to repay the $100,000 plus interest. We treat that piece of paper, that IOU, that promise to pay, we treat it in a debt-based monetary system, we treat it as if it were a real asset. And it's not. It's a promise to pay. An asset is something you have in your pocket. A promise to pay is saying, oh, I'm going to give you that asset. I'll send you the asset a year from now or 5 years from now. But you don't actually have the asset. You just have a promise to pay in a world where the debt is so enormous that we can't pay all the debt. And that means that a whole bunch of those paper debt instruments are going to turn out to be worthless. When they cancel the debt, the correlative paper instruments turn out to be worthless. When the paper debt instruments turn out to be worthless, our stocks and our bonds and so on, where do we find the capital to invest in the next factory or shopping center or in rebuilding infrastructure in the United States? If the debt can't be paid, we lose the paper debt assets that virtually everyone relies on. And that puts us into a terrible economic situation. All right? It's something that we will not be able to escape easily or painlessly. And it's going to happen sooner or later, although I don't know when. It has to happen. The debt can't be paid. Well, what I'm beginning to understand about the debt, I had only looked at it from the perspective up until just recently. I'd only focused on the idea that the principal of the debt, the $17 trillion, if we believe the government's official estimate of the debt, or the $90 trillion, according to John Williams, or the $202 trillion, according to the Congressional Budget Office, I'd only looked at it in terms of the principal, the $17 trillion, the $90 trillion, the $202 trillion. Okay? But I'm beginning to see that equally important is the interest on the debt. And then a lot of people said, well, that's not surprising. What took me so long to pick up on it? It's important for this reason. As long as the government can pay the interest on the existing debt, those loans are deemed to be performing loans. They still have value, and we can sustain the illusion that the bonds are valuable and so on. But if we reach a point where the government can't even pay the interest on the debt, that will signal that the debt can't be paid. We're not talking about can you pay the principal? Can you pay the $17 trillion? No, that's not what we're not talking. We're saying they can't even pay the interest on the $17 trillion. And I have a suspicion. I'm going to do more research on this and try to understand this better for myself and for the audience over the course of the next, who knows, days or weeks, however long it takes me, to see if the suspicion is right. But I think they are caught in a place where they can't pay the principal, and they may be near to the point where they can't even pay the interest. And if that's true, then we're on the verge. To the extent that's true, it might be a year from now, maybe 5 years from now, I don't know. But when we get to the point that they can't even pay the interest, then I think the illusion has to collapse. And with it, the value of the dollar, and at that moment in time, anybody who's got paper is going to be wiped out, and those who have gold and silver are going to say, yippee. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Alfred Adisk here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer. Bye.
I work all night, I work all day, to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me.